the voters passed a ballot measure that decriminalized drug possession for all drugs, not just marijuana. But the population of Oregon made a collective judgment that for people engaged in low-level drug use, regardless of the drug, the best, most reasonable, most appropriate response is treatment, not prison. And that also is a philosophical corner that we're turning as a people that is something to be proud of. So what we need to do now is we need to take Oregon to other states, and when we're having this conversation 5 years from now, have Oregon be the default as opposed to the, you know, one-of-a-kind event that happened this electoral cycle.
We want to thank you, Ronald Newman, for joining us. And we're going to talk to you after the show and post it online about the right to counsel for people who are facing eviction in Boulder, Colorado. Also, we want to talk about low-wage jobs and what happened with legislation there. Ronald Newman, ACLU National Political Director. A very happy birthday to Carla Wills. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 7:59 a.m. Next up, we have Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy.
Good morning. Good morning. Hello. That mellifluous voice is Tracy Simmons, our illustrious co-host. My name is Abe Proctor. This is Too Much Information on KBOO 90.7 FM. We hope you're doing well on this overcast Tuesday morning in the Pacific Northwest. Tracy, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Good morning, Abe. Good morning, listeners. You know, I'm just kind of reveling in, you know, the holiday season. It's very strange. You know, planning a lot of nothing. At this point, I'd usually have back-to-back holiday parties. And, you know, I'm really excited that I don't have all of that. I'm saving lots of money. I'm being safe and conscientious about my health and the health of other people. And I have no plans. It's kind of freeing. What about you? How are you doing?
Yeah, you know, I'm feeling sort of similarly. It's tinged with regret, obviously. I mean, the aforementioned holiday parties and get-togethers, yes, are stressful and time-consuming, but I would love to see some of those faces. Haven't seen many of them for a long, long time. So it is what it is, holiday season in this most godforsaken year. But there are a few hopeful notes that are sounding out there. not the least of which is that Great Britain began the first mass inoculation campaign against COVID-19 in the world. They're using the vaccine developed by Pfizer. They have about 800,000 doses of the vaccine, and they are beginning to administer it to their population starting today. The very first person to receive the vaccine as part of this campaign was a 90-year-old woman. Interestingly, I think that gives a good indication of where Great Britain's priorities are with regard to the distribution of this vaccine, something I hope that the United States pays attention to.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she was just the cutest little lady. And, you know, to live 90 years and then succumb to a very preventable virus is just unconscionable. And so I'm along with you. I hope that our strategy is around protecting the most vulnerable first. Of course, protecting our healthcare workers and getting them vaccinated so they can continue doing the heroic work of saving the rest of us, and then move on from there to other populations who are vulnerable. I'm super excited about that. I mean, I think all of us would love to get back to normal life, and it feels like a crack is emerging, right? There's light seeping through. And so I'm super hopeful about that. We've seen Obama out in the world as well. You know, of course, for me, he was not necessarily a perfect figure, but a hopeful figure for me. And he's been kind of, you know, showing up at different evening shows and in the space. And you know, I think many of us
promoting a book. Yeah.
Exactly. a 700-page book that might have a sequel to it.
volume one. Writing the next Game of Thrones.
But out there, just, you know, kind of on the stump, although he's not being elected for anything, and has been saying some really interesting things. So, you know, our theme today is really talking about this whole defund the police, which Obama came out and said, you know, you lose folks with snappy slogans like defund the police. And I think the activist community kind of went crazy. They kind of went off the rails based on the statement. And so I'm hoping today that we can have a really good discussion about, you know, what is defund the police? Is it a slogan? What is it? Are we talking about demilitarization? Are we talking about reform? What are we talking about? Because I think there's just so much mystique that is not mystical. It's pretty straightforward. So I'm excited to have that conversation with you, Abe. And I, you know, I'm hoping that our callers will call in and add to the conversation. Because I think it's just an important time that we can begin to have these discussions and have honest discussions about why people push back on the idea of defunding police, the true function of police and punishment. So let's do it. When you hear defund the police, Abe, what do you think? What does that mean in your mind? What is the conceptions of your brain when you hear that?
Well, honestly, my conception and my opinion of the phrase has changed over time. When it first arose in the midst of the movement for Black Lives this summer, I initially was critical, mostly for lack of a better term, from a marketing standpoint. Like, this is, you know, any slogan that you, you know, where you immediately have to add a bunch of caveats after you say it maybe isn't the best slogan from a marketing perspective. If you're out there and you say defund the police, by which I mean A, B, C, D, and E, that rhetorically, you know, doesn't work so well. So that was my criticism of it originally. But, you know, upon further reflection and upon about what members of the activist community have to say, I've come around to the position that I think it's, you know, it's entirely accurate. It is entirely accurate. We're talking about the redistribution of resources to respond to emergencies in different ways, to find alternatives to sending the guys with the badges and the guns all the time. And of course, a necessary component of that a necessary stop along the way is starving that beast of the resources it needs. You know, if there's fewer armed policemen on the streets, that goes a long way towards solving this problem. In the final analysis, I think defund the police makes perfect sense and describes quite accurately what we need to do. And with regard to the marketing aspect of it, well, you know, I would encourage people perhaps to think a little bit more deeply on it about what it actually means. And we also need to acknowledge something that's very important in this scenario, and that is there will never be a term or a process for combating racism that will be acceptable to racists. So, I mean, it's a very simple concept, but it's very true, right? There's no step you can take towards dismantling systemic racism that will be acceptable to racists. So for those people who are objecting to defund the police on those grounds, well, I don't know what to tell you.
I mean, spot on, absolutely. And to think that because people don't initially support something that it is invalid or that it is not a good argument is ridiculous, right? We think about, you know, just 20 years ago we were fighting for the rights of LGBT people to get married, right? We were fighting for basic things that now, you know, when we're thinking about decriminalization of marijuana, and even in Oregon, decriminalization of other drugs, right? These things are not something that people initially take to as great ideas, right? It takes some time to understand. But what's interesting is we've been defunding public education for at least 40 years, my lifetime. We've defunded things like health care. We continue to fight against the social safety net of Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. And so defunding things is not something that we are objective to, right? We don't, like, automatically say, oh, no, that's not a good idea. I think what has happened is that we have this conception of the police as equating to safety. And in most communities, there is no evidence that having more police equals safety. What we see in the kind of neighborhoods and places where there is low crime, high levels of self-actualization, there are lots of resources, right? And so part of the fund idea to take some of that funding that goes into, you know, getting tanks and rubber shells and gassing our citizens, taking some of that money and funding things like social services, right? Focusing on mental health support, behavioral health support, helping the houseless and unhoused communities. Thinking about, do we need armed police to engage in routine traffic stops? Probably not. I don't believe so. And right now, in places like Portland, Oregon, and the metro area, there is a camera on just about every stoplight and almost every corner. And so we can use different kinds of technologies to manage the safety of the streets with regard to traffic, right? We have so many different mechanisms and technologies at our disposal to do some of the things that the police are currently you know, responsible for, but oftentimes ends up in abuse of our citizens. There's, you know, high levels of surveillance and brutalization that are happening through that militarized equipment, and some of the tactics are very, very brutal. And so why do we continue to fund that? It's because we have conceived of policing as equal to safety.
Yes, but there's a very important piece of subtext to that statement you just made. I absolutely concur with everything you said, including this notion that equating a strong police force with a safe community. In the minds of many white people, historically in the United States, this has meant that my community will be safe from the danger that I perceive to reside in this neighboring community of color. And the police are largely there to keep me safe from those people. I'm sorry, I think we're having a technical difficulties there for a second. So it gets back to this racial separation I was talking about. There's a widespread perception, and I think it's been more true historically than perhaps it is at the present day, that the police exist to keep white communities safe from the danger they believe resides within communities of color. Now, this is something that's characterized the police force and people's attitude towards the police force, I think, since the very earliest origins of police, that we absolutely need to combat and overcome. And I think when we talk about defunding the police, this is what we're talking about, a deliberate attempt to dismantle this system that has served as a wedge between the dominant culture and communities of culture throughout the United States for all of its history. All right, we seem to be having some more problems keeping Tracy on the line. So please bear with us, listeners, as we try and figure this out. So there's, like I'm saying, there's a lot to this problem, I think, than, is immediately apparent to most people. And I think that's at the heart of why President Obama describes this as, a problem with a snappy slogan, a problem that loses a lot of people, because most people don't want to have to think too deeply about this problem. They hear something like defund the police, and that reinforces all these negative racial emotions that I just got done describing. Now, I'm going to have to beg your indulgence, listeners, here for just a minute as we try and figure out how to bring Tracy back on board this phone call. So hang on, please, just one moment. In fact, Ty, even if you might be able to play a spot while we figure this out, that might be the best course of action. All right. Do we have you back, Tracy?
Can you hear me?
Yes. Are you back with us?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm not really sure what the source of the problem was. Thank you, listeners, for indulging us as we figured this out. I was on an epic rant about, the racial origins and perceptions of policing in the United States. So take it away. Are we there? Oh, my goodness. Listeners, I am so sorry about this problem we seem to be having. I'm going to ask our engineer, Ty, to step in here for just a moment and put something up so that we can figure this out. And we'll be right back with you. All right. Are we back?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure what the hell is going on here.
I do not have any idea. So I think what is interesting about understanding policing from a historical perspective is that policing is a vestige of slave patrols, right?
Yes.
Runaway slaves get out of control. We've got to get them back. And then after slavery, right, in the Jim Crow era, it was really about controlling white spaces and protecting them from black bodies, right? And so part of the concept of policing is about social control, not about safety. And when you think about even, if anyone's called the police for something like, I've called the police before because my car was broken into, and literally they gave me a piece of paper and said, thanks, and left, and I never heard anything back. There was no investigation. I'm sure, it's not a big deal, whatever, my car was broken into. I was young, and I didn't understand that they had no energy for that. And they didn't solve a crime. And what we know historically is that policing doesn't necessarily solve crimes. There is a very small portion of the police force that is dedicated to the detective work and solving crimes, but we know that it's not successful as we look at kind of overall trends with policing and crime solving. There wouldn't be shows dedicated to solving unsolved crimes if it was a successful endeavor. So we think about that. We think about the kind of the vestiges of policing as really about controlling space, controlling bodies, specifically Black bodies, indigenous bodies, and also thinking about the ways in which it is really about controlling and supporting the rights of property owners, right? And so even in, you know, the whole summer-long protest, you know, they were being declared riots by police because a window was being broken, right? And the whole concept of the protest was over actual humans being killed at the hands of police with impunity, right? No consequence at all whatsoever. And what we know about extrajudicial police killings, 99% of those are not prosecuted, right? So nobody ever goes to jail for those killings. And we've seen some quite terrible instances of that recently, and I won't go into all of that. But so police aren't solving crimes. Police are abusing and harming people. You know, a random traffic stop that, you know, someone is detected of a marijuana smell or some other narcotic smell becomes, you know, a 10-mile chase. People are harmed. It you know, could end up in a shooting that is officer involved. And at the end of it, we say, well, that's safety. No, it's not. Part of safety is investing in humans. But in order to really think that we would invest deeply in actual humans and take some of that money from policing would mean that we would have to see each other, individuals in the community, as wonderfully made and worthy of an investment. And what we see is the opposite, that we have really bought into this hierarchy of human value where we see some people as just less valuable. Throw them away, lock them up, you know, do what you can. We have something like 5,000 different prisons and jails in the United States. And the cost of that in the prison industrial complex is huge. If we would use that money to invest in people, invest in mental health, invest in behavioral health, invest in education, you know, invest in housing for the houseless, we would see a lack of need to create the conditions for antisocial behaviors, right? When we do things like, you know, fund the public good, the common good, we see pro-social environments being created. And the lack of a need for people to fight for, you know, the scarce resources that are available. And so, to me, safety is a function of resources and giving people what they individually need to be safe and healthy and function as a society. And policing is oftentimes about scarcity, holding people in control, and using that control to manage people as opposed to allow them to be self-actualized and engaged citizens.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think it's so important for us to not only understand but distinguish between, you know, the need for law enforcement in the abstract and the actual practices put into play by law enforcement officers in the real world. It's no secret that communities of color are over-policed in comparison to white communities. And just by virtue of that increased level of police presence, and also by virtue of the way that many police officers conduct themselves when dealing with people of color as opposed to members of the dominant culture, you end up with a situation like we have today. If you've got more police in a community of color, if they deal with people of color in an inherently different manner, then you have, you know, the infamous infinite number of stories that almost any person of color could tell you about being pulled over for driving while Black or being followed around through a store while you shop, and all these different ways in which the suspicion of the state is turned upon people who are not members of the dominant culture, and the way that that suspicion is undergirded by the muscle of the state, which is too often in the form of lethal violence. All of this stems from the way, as you mentioned, Tracy, that from the get-go, police enforcement in this country has been based around controlling communities of color. Quite literally, in the beginning, when they were formed to actually chase down and retrieve runaway slaves. And part of that function explicitly was to ensure their safety, at least the perceived safety, in the minds of white communities, that they would be inoculated from whatever harm these wild and rampaging free slaves might visit upon their homes. So it's impossible to talk about policing in the United States without mentioning the racial element, because they are two sides of a coin.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, and I have friends who work in law enforcement. What's interesting even about their responses in the community, I think, you know, I've called police maybe a handful of times in my life. And whenever I really needed something, guess who came? The firefighters.
Right.
Solve the situation. No one's asking to defund the fire, right? The fire department.
Yeah.
And I think that it could bring us to thinking about these things. Like, why do we consider the only way to attain safety is through policing? Because it's the narrative. I just remember being a kiddo and in school, you know, the police are your friend and this and that. And then as I, you know, grew into my adult black woman self and was getting pulled over, I got pulled over one time for accelerating through the yellow light. And I was like, what?
That's what the yellow light is for. You see the yellow light, you're supposed to accelerate.
I couldn't.
Is that right?
So, of course, I don't want to be caught in the middle of the red light. I pulled over for erroneous, I mean, the most ridiculous crimes that aren't crimes, infractions. I remember one time, and this was, you know, upon newly moving into my neighborhood, a woman came banging on my door. My partner and I are in the living room, open the door. She says, you know, please let me use your cell phone. I'm being abused by my boyfriend two doors down, two houses down from us. She uses my partner's cell phone, calls the police. She's a white woman. We are two black individuals. And the police arrive on the scene, and you know, the woman is still in our front porch telling the police, you know, he's over there. Well, my partner is a black man, and he's at the door. The police begin to push into our door, into our house, while the woman is saying, the person that abused me is over in that house over there. And so we're going like, what are they, like, literally pushed into our house to try and get my partner.
Well, conveniently, we have a black man right here. So let's just take care of this one.
That's exactly what it felt like. And then there was a standoff with the person in the house who happened to not be a black man. It was a white man who was abusing his partner, and it turned into a full standoff. So needless to say, I think what also is what underlies this is what you said, right? The response that we get as people of color when we call the police is very different than the response that other people get. And so the idea of safety and how the police are working or not working is predicated on people's lived experiences and interactions with that particular subset of people in our society, right? And so, you know, I couldn't say that I would, you know, fully identify as a defund the policer if I had a different lived experience.
I think that's fair to say. Yeah, how do you think that ties into President Obama's observations that a lot of people are lost because that slogan, defund the police, was rolled out?
Well, I think he's really speaking from, I don't even know, because I don't think there's evidence that says that any person that lost their candidacy in the 2020 election lost it because they said that defunding the police was a good thing. So I don't even know if there's a correlation there. I do think that as a centrist Democrat, which I see Obama as a centrist Democrat, the idea for him and other centrists is to appease as much as you can the centrist wing of the Republican Party in your efforts to win them over. And what we're seeing is that is not also a winning strategy generally. And if it were, we would have seen, Hillary Clinton win. And we didn't see that because I think the idea that you're going to pull off or pick off some, you know, of the electorate that usually votes Republican by being mealy-mouthed and not really saying what you mean or meaning what you say, I don't think that's a good strategy. But obviously, there is a part of the Democratic Party that thinks that that is that centrist-leaning, don't say things that are going to piss off white supremacists, don't say things that are going to offend the people who need to vote for us, without considering the people who aren't voting for you at all, because you're not saying anything that's speaking to them, right? And I've talked about this before, but I wish progressives would stop worrying about picking off people who have no interest in the common good, have no interest in creating a more diverse, equitable, inclusive society, and focus on the people who aren't voting at all because we haven't done anything to win their energy, their enthusiasm, because they're not speaking to the real problems that they are facing in their lives, right? And we've talked about things like really, you know, funding the public good. There's a lot of energy right now around basic needs and meeting people's basic needs in the middle of a pandemic when we're seeing, you know, tons of people who are facing eviction. I think the average arrears of rent in Oregon is something like $5,000+. I don't know where people are going to come up with that money once the eviction moratorium ends, but it's going to end. We see food lines, long as all get out, because we haven't been able to fund the public good. And so I think what the strategy needs to be is focus on what people actually need in their lives and support that. And we could do that by reducing these oversized post-budget and still have a functioning police. The police are not going to be defunded to be abolished. I don't see that as a good strategy, right? I think that's a little extreme for my taste. But I think we could absolutely repurpose those funds, reallocate those funds to meet the needs of actual people.
Right. I mean, you're still going to need somebody to solve murders, right? Or recover stolen property, right? There's a legitimate function for the police in society. I think that at the heart of the defund the police movement and slogan and identity or whatever you want to call it, is this notion that among those legitimate functions, you're not going to find brutalizing people of color. That should not be there. That should not be a function of the police departments, any police department in the United States. Let's go to the phones. We got Molly up first. Good morning. Well, let's go to Francesca. What's on your mind?
Hello?
Okay. Hello. Are you there?
Hey.
Hi, who are we talking to?
Well, my name is Pear.
Hey, Pear, welcome to the show. I'm sorry, we are having like a cavalcade of technical problems this morning.
I think so.
I'm glad you're with us.
I just wanted
What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that defunding the police is just, it's just sloppy language. It's got everybody confused. So, very sloppy.
What would you propose?
How about downsize?
Downsize, okay.
Downsize.
Downsize the police.
I'm sure we could think of a better word than defund. It just it's got everybody confused. So, reform the police. I mean, that's an old one. You know, it still hasn't been done. There've been attempts at it, but. Still needs to be done. They just have, I think they have too many jobs to do, and then not enough training to do it.
See, the problem I have with the slogan "Reform the Police," you know, while it might evoke, a more benign set of circumstances in many people's minds, it doesn't get to the nub of the problem, which is that this machine, which grinds up bodies of color, needs to be starved. It needs its resources taken away and redirected to other ends. It's, I don't know if reform really gets to that the way it needs to. Well, I don't know. Maybe we're talking about mostly a rhetorical difference here.
Well, I think, yeah, well, it is that we're getting bogged down in rhetoric when, the problem is that the police are being sent to into situations where they have no training, you know, like people with mental problems or just all kinds of things going on where they should have, or you could say help the police do their job, I don't know, but defunding just is sloppy language, it really is.
Okay. Hey, well, listen, thank you for the call.
Yep.
And I have to say, downsize the police, that's not bad. I don't know if it has, it's quite sufficient, but it's not bad.
I think to our caller's point, what I'm talking about is taking some of the funding that goes to police to prevent even the need for police to respond to mental health issues. What we know in Portland, Oregon, is that in 2017, while the houseless community made up about 3% of the population, they were about 50% of the police stops and arrests. And when we think about that proportionality or disproportionality, there's a problem there, right? If we had housing and if we had the resources in behavioral health and mental health, and we could, you know, give people really good, well-paying jobs to do this work, we wouldn't have to have police stopping and you know, interacting with this group of people in the same way. And so, you know, I hear folks, I've heard the reform word a lot. It gets tossed around often. But I don't know how you reform an organization that is really absolutely conceived in the notion of a hierarchy of human value and in white supremacy. I don't know how you reform something like that. I think, you know, downsizing might be a way to go. I'm open. I stay open. But I don't think it's really saying what we are really trying to say. Defund means take the funds away and put them somewhere else.
Yeah. Agreed. And you're right. And inherent in this whole notion is a complete reconception of how we approach responding to emergencies, all based on the idea that maybe, perhaps most of the time, the guys with the guns and badges are not the people you should be sending. Do you need to send an armed person to a domestic dispute? Probably not. Probably you're going to want to send a counselor. Probably you're going to need mental health professionals with a range of specialties to be deployed in various sorts of situations. You're going to need people with knowledge of addiction issues and dependency issues. There's a whole range of emergencies that Americans experience on an everyday basis that need the intervention of somebody. And usually an armed police officer is not the right person. So that's really what we're talking about. And I think it's a necessary step towards creating a system, as you mentioned, Tracy, that's predicated on inclusivity and equity rather than the de facto segregation that our law enforcement institutions have enforced over the centuries in the United States.
Yeah. You know, the last couple times I've had certain things happen, I've had things stolen off my property, I've had things stolen out of my car, I haven't even bothered to call the police because it's futile. They're not going to do anything about it. They're not going to investigate my bike that got stolen, right? They're not going to investigate the fact that my car was rifled through and you know, I have papers in there that were stolen as well as sunglasses. But I also have to recognize that if there were conditions in our society where people had their basic needs met, they wouldn't be rifling through my car, right? I don't know anyone who is well-employed and successful that goes around committing larceny on their neighbor. And so I really think it's about conceiving of society differently, not only the police, but society differently, where we recognize that not all people have everything that they need, and that we recognize that as a, you know, for the purpose of really creating better social bonds that we take care of each other. But as long as there's this hierarchy, right, where we say, oh, those people just, you know, they're just going to be that way, or, oh, they want to be homeless, or they want to be houseless. We make up things in our mind to justify why we treat people certain ways. And when you look at kind of the statistics on incarceration, and specifically long-term incarceration, and you notice the amount of people who are incarcerated long-term for nonviolent crimes, we can also see that the system is broken, but not just at the policing level, every level of the system, right? There really is no purpose for people who have committed nonviolent crimes to be locked away for any long-term period. If you don't believe in people and the worth of the people, to invest in their rehabilitation, whether that's through educational programs, programs to help people be uplifted through learning, you know, marketable skills for jobs. If you don't believe in that, you won't actually see that as an option or an opportunity to change the way we have really, you know, constructed our society.
Yeah, completely agree. Tyler writes in to say, does the funding take opportunity away from police to add unarmed response teams? They need money to do that. And the language defunding doesn't speak to that need and purpose. That's a very good question. I think in the situation that Tracy and I are describing is that the police would be just one small aspect of a broad spectrum of emergency response options. So yes, among that spectrum would be what Tyler refers to as an unarmed response team, you know, maybe where you send in a social worker and a counselor instead of a couple of cops. This is what we're talking about. We're talking about completely reimagining how we respond to people in crisis. So instead of having, for example, a Portland Police Bureau or a Portland Fire Bureau, we might have a more overarching agency called the Portland Bureau of Emergency Response. And nested within that are things like the police department, the fire department, the social work office, a group of counselors, and so on and so on. And between and among all these options, we find a way to comprehensively address somebody's crisis that doesn't involve tools that point almost necessarily towards an escalation of tensions and the possibility of deadly violence. That's what we're trying to avoid. And that's why that part of the law enforcement apparatus needs defunding. That sound about right?
Yeah, it sounds great to me. I think about even in Multnomah County, there's the behavioral health unit, and they are way understaffed, and the need is so great. These folks oftentimes do, emergency checks on folks. They will follow up on reports of a person having a mental health crisis, but they largely don't have the resources that they need. What I'm talking about is repurposing police dollars to support that. I would also say that we don't need more police or more people in uniform to do these services. How about we don't, you know, add to the budget by hiring more people to do the work of policing, but we, you know, say, hey, you don't need a gun, you don't need a taser, you know, let's help the people who are actually doing the work reconceive of their work as well. But for me, it's more so investing in the social safety net that prevents us from getting to the point where we have all of these emergent situations. Oftentimes, the emergent situation arises from a person not having their needs met. I will continue to say this. If you are getting support for your behavioral health on a regular basis, and if you're getting support for your mental health on a regular basis, the likelihood that you're going to have a mental health crisis and the police are going to be called on you is low. If you are, you know, committing larceny on your neighbors because you don't have your basic needs met, the police won't be called. If we have an apparatus for delivering, healthy food, housing, physical health support, right? We wouldn't have that. And so it's really about not only the response aspect of policing, but also really reinvesting in the social safety net that we have largely abandoned. And at the same time, we have allowed for highly wealthy individuals to have more than they could ever need while the rest of us are fighting for the scarcity and the scraps that are left over. And so there's also a fundamental shift that we would need to make in the tax system to also be able to support this public safety net.
I totally agree, and I would like to follow up on that in just a minute. But first, let's go to Karen, who is standing by. Karen, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for wonderful and important information and perspective, Tracy and Abe. I just wanted to, and it's been touched on, I just wanted to focus on a little bit what the financial aspect of all this is. And I think I would like to see a state-run or Portland or Oregon-run jobs program for people who've been in prison. I would also like to understand better what the financial incentives are for the police to arrest people. And I was thinking, I mean, I understand racism, and racism has a life of its own, separate from, independent of economics, but it is related too. And I was thinking of all that equipment, all that militarized crap, I'm sorry, that the police have, that turns it into an even greater horror show when they're deployed, and how much that's influencing policies and reluctance to change and so on. So I'd love to take your comments off the air. I'd love to hear what you have to say about the financial end of things. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for the call. Now,
so there's a meeting within the police force that is around asset forfeitures and seizures. That is a cash cow. And so if you can pull someone over and say, you know, they have some drugs in their car, you, as the police, can literally take their car, take the cash that they have in hand, and now that's yours. It is a cash cow. And then, not even to mention the bail system. The cash bail system is another way in which inequity is doled out, by saying, if you have enough money to get yourself out of jail today that we've taken you there, you can get out. Just give us the money. And so it really is a financial system that is working for certain people. We know, you know, Kyle Rittenhouse, the shooter from Kenosha, Wisconsin, who shot and killed two people in the protest in the summer, was bailed out, I think, $1 million because people raised his bail. But that money goes back into the policing system. And so I really want to say that these two ways in which assets are being seized and forfeited, and bail is being used as a slush fund for greater resources for policing, is not lost on me. And it shouldn't be lost on anybody else. Not to mention, right, there's a private for-profit prison system as well. And so that's prison industrial complex, that people are literally making money off of holding people, you know, in bondage, basically, and oftentimes for nonviolent crimes. I absolutely believe that, you know, violent criminals who have been, you know, proven to not at all benefit from any, you know, investment in rehabilitation, are likely not to be the people that I would consider needing and deserving to be out in the public sphere, because, right, I do believe that safety is important, but there are a lot of people who are literally making money for private prisons just, you know, because they did something that was a nonviolent crime that they are now being locked up forever for.
Yes, absolutely right. There's also a more overarching political thing at play here, and that is that, going back in time for a moment, the dramatic cuts in income taxes for the highest earners that first became in vogue in the Reagan years, and also the caps on property taxes that were enacted first in California in the late 70s and then in a lot of other states, has resulted in a funding scenario in which local governments, cities, counties, so on, are starved for the resources they need to adequately govern their jurisdiction. So this has meant that over and over again, there have been dramatic cuts to social service programs in municipalities and in counties across the country. What's happened, though, at the same time that all of these necessary services have been cut so deeply, is that in community after community, you find law enforcement agencies are largely immune to the budget cuts that have so deeply impacted some of their sister agencies. And the reason for this goes back to the perception of safety and the perception that people have of the police, the function of law enforcement, and how it's tied up in those conceptions of safety, and also how people fear a world in which we have a smaller police presence. So you can look at case after case in communities across the country, Los Angeles perhaps most notoriously, where even in the face of dramatic budget cuts to very necessary social services, things that might prevent the rise of emergent situations like you were talking about, Tracy, even as those things are going on, you see law enforcement agencies experiencing budget increases, or at least being able to avoid the cuts that are bedeviling the rest of city government. So it's a big problem. And you couple that with other overarching political factors, like the fact that because of the continuity and funding that most law enforcement agencies can expect, you find situations where police chiefs become enormously powerful political figures, and alongside them, police unions. So again, if you do a little digging in communities around the country, you can find situations where, for example, if you're a mayor and you want to be, or if you're a candidate for a mayorship and you want to get elected, you absolutely must have the support of the police chief and the police union, or you're not going to earn your office. So it's a multi-layered problem. It's absolutely the case that it's a multi-layered problem.
Part of the embeddedness there is about funding those campaigns. You need that $15,000 fund from the police union and that $20,000 fund from the police bureau as endorsements, right? So there's all kind of ways that money is tied into the situation. And once again, right, if we could see, you know, humans as the proper investment, we would shift that conceptualization of our brains to think about how do we actually invest in people? What kind of investment do people need? And I can't say it enough, but in this current moment where we see crime rising in the city of Portland, there's been more shootings in the city of Portland on record, and we're on track to have more ever this year. It is a function of scarcity, right? People are out of jobs, out of work. Mm-hmm. The unemployment is super high in the city. We've seen, the crime rates oftentimes rise with the unemployment rate because people don't have their basic needs met. I would just say, if we could do any one thing, I think it's worth people investigating what defund means. And if you come up with a better slogan, please share it. But I don't think activists are really worried about the slogan. They're more worried about really how do they get this policy objective to filter down at the local level where these decisions are being made. There's a lot of money in policing, but there's not a lot of money in even for people who are working in behavioral health and mental health. Those jobs are thankless jobs. We don't pay those people enough. And if we wanted to increase employment, we would employ people who were doing and serving the common good. But we have also defunded that strategy as well. So defunding is not a new tactic. It's just one that people will not get behind when we're talking about the police.
Let's go to Robbie. Good morning, Robbie.
Hey, good morning. Love the conversation. It's stuff that obviously I've been thinking about a lot. For the longest time, you just said it, Tracy, is like, I didn't think defund the police is a bad message. I don't look at it as bad. I think I place the blame on people who aren't willing to understand that the police force is a racist pillar built on oppression, the private prison industry using, you know, basically putting, and here's the thing, the low-level drug offenders, if you run a prison industry, you don't want the violent criminals. They cost you money. You want the low-level drug offenders because they're easy to take care of. So the entire system, but I got the better slogan for you, right? I got the better slogan. and we should just rethink the police. We should rethink the police, and here's the reason why. Because every person that will say, like, oh, well, you know, defund is scary or whatever, it's just like, okay, who's going to police the police? Who's, like, they can agree. These people that are, you know, saying defund the police is a scary message, it's like, surely they know that there are bad police officers out there, so who's going to police the police? And if they're acting like a gang, if whistleblowing police are actually getting arrested, I don't know if you'd heard about, you know, the few cases that I'd heard about where a police officer tries to do the right thing and whistleblows on his department. Next thing you know, that cop is now arrested in jail, and it's like, it's a gang first and foremost, right? So we should be rethinking the police. And when we say rethink the police, hopefully, obviously, that characterizes defunding them and reallocating the resources elsewhere. But, you know, ultimately, if we're rethinking the police, we get to ask these questions. Okay, who's going to police the police? You know, who's going to, you know, and hopefully, and I don't have much faith in it, but, you know, because, like, the entire system, the entire police force is based on this oppression from, you know, everything you described. I don't need to go into it again, but it's unless we're trying to bring that up and be like, okay, how do we address all these problems? We need to rethink the police. Maybe that would be a better digestible thing. But if I could bring up one last point, I don't know if you wanted to chat about that for a second, but there's one last point I would like to bring up. This morning.
Okay, that's fine. Right, just make it quickly.
Okay, this morning, the Red House on Mississippi, which was facing an eviction, the police showed up there today. So I got to I got to talk to a bunch of police and ask them, who are you protecting and who are you serving by evicting a family during the eviction moratorium? Like, how you know, who is it that you're protecting and making safer by evicting? Anyway, that's going on at the Red House on Mississippi, 503-423. Oh, shoot, I forget the number. It's 503-823-4120 is Ted Wheeler's phone number, but I'm trying to get people to ask these questions right now about the Red House. So anyway, thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for the call, Robbie. Quickly before the end, let's go to Harry. Harry, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. About the defund the police, where did it actually come from? Well, when Floyd was killed, the city council got together, Floyd was in, they asked the police to make some changes. And what did the police? The police were arrogant, and they said, no, we have a contract. We'll see you in 3 years or 5 years or whatever it was. They did not want to cooperate. And it came from that city council about defunding the police because they were so upset. But here in Portland, Joanne Hardesty and Chloe also asked about defunding the police, and of course during the election, Commissioner Chloe was defeated. So I think it was just a tactic, but here in Portland what happened was people had a choice, either defund the police or pass the ballot measure which controlled the police. And the ballot measure passed, which was good, and so we don't have to defund the police. In fact, if I'm correct, they just, about a week or two ago, they did the budget for next year, and they increased the police budget.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, okay. But that's what I was going to say, exactly where it came, the word came from, defund the police. Who was the one who actually used it? Of course, it caught fire and went across the country. So both good and bad. Anyway, that's all. That's my comment I have.
Hey, thank you, Harry. Appreciate the call. Well, Tracy, I think it's about time to put a button on this episode. How do you want to take us out today?
Well, you know, I don't know that it matters where the words came from. I don't think it does. I think it just really matters where we go from here. I think we have to hold our elected officials absolutely accountable. And, you know, I was really disappointed in what happened with the Portland election at the city level. You know, I'm not going to go too deeply into that. But, you know, I think we need to continue putting pressure on, and maybe we don't say defund the police, but we actually put pressure on funding the common good. We have done a terrible job in the city of Portland and in the state of Oregon with our support for our houseless communities. We've done a terrible job with the education system that's been defunded for at least 30, 40 years. And so we need to start putting pressure on the people who set policies around and with our new conception of safety as an investment in humans. So that's all I'll say for today. I hope everyone has an amazing week and stay safe out there. What say you, Abe?
Well, I enjoyed the conversation, both with you and our listeners today, as always. I still believe that embedded within any notion of how we reform or downsize or rethink or do anything to law enforcement, there needs to be an understanding that that means resources are going to get diverted from what we traditionally conceive of as policing towards more constructive, more human-centered needs. And I hope we don't lose that in the course of this conversation. So this has been Too Much Information. My name's Abe Proctor. We're joined today by Tracy Simmons and all of our wonderful listeners. Thank you to everyone who contributed today. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, and we'll be back at you next week.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of Holding the Thin Green Line. This documentary slideshow tells the stories of people fighting to save the souls of their communities.